because he's a busy man. And I got in front of his desk, about like I am you, and he didn't have a great big desk. And I reached over and I said, "Mr. President, my name's George McInturf. I'm from Chattanooga." And he said, "Wait just a minute. I want to talk to you." And he got up and he came around in front of the table and threw his right leg over the table. And I stood right in front of him and put my arm over on his left shoulder. He said, "Did you ever know Nate Bachman in Chattanooga?"
Nathan Bachman, huh?
Nathan Bachman.
Mm-hmm.
Whose father was the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church so long. A name that was reverend in this part of
the Bachman tubes.
Yeah. And I said, "Why, Mr. President, everybody knew Nate Bachman." He said, "Well, he's the best damn friend I had in Washington." That's just the way he spoke. And said, early one morning, I was in the bathroom shaving, getting ready to go to the Senate. And said, Bess came running into me and said, "Harry, I've just had a call from Bethesda Hospital that Nate Bachman was taken to the hospital in the middle of the night and wants you to come by and see him."
He was a Tennessee senator at that
That's
time.
To see him on your way to the office. And the president said, I rushed out there and I walked in his room and said, there laid old Nate in bed. And he said, "Harry, I'm gonna die." He said, "Nate, you're too damn mean to die." He said, "No, Harry, I'm gonna die. I've made it right with my Lord, and I want you to be one of the senators that accompanies my body to Chattanooga. But don't grieve after old Nate, because I'm all right. I want you to have a good time. Chattanooga is a beautiful place. I want you to see it." And said, "I came." And said, "I was put in charge of a city attorney in Chattanooga named Joe Anderson. He was to show me Chattanooga." And I said, "Well, Mr. President, Joe Anderson is still the city attorney." He said, "He sure must be an old so-and-so, ain't he?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I stayed in room 814 at the Patton Hotel." And he said, "All I could do was to look out over that old railroad station with all those sheds." And said, "One day, Joe Anderson came to get me and took me to some place called St. Elmo and stopped me in front of an incline and got out with me. And he said, now, Senator, I'm going to get you a ticket and you're going to ride that incline up the top of the mountain. And I'm going to drive up there and meet you." He said, "You're not going to drive up there and meet me. I'm not going to ride that incline. If I'm going up this mountain, I'm going with you." And he said, "Mr. Anderson took me up the mountain." And then he said, "McInturf, where old Nate lived up on Walden Ridge, there was some man that lived there close to him that I can't for the life of myself think of what his name was. But he said he made the best corn whiskey that a man ever drank. And he used to send it regularly to Nate, and Nate would always give me some of it." And I said, "Well, Mr. President, you're talking about Uncle Joe Ma." He said, "That's his name. That's his name." And he asked me what had happened to him. I said, "Well, after Senator Bachman died, they sent him to the pen for a year or two. But he said the only reason they did was because Nate Bachman wasn't there to keep him out of it. But he said, the thing that I remember most about Chattanooga is that when you pour a fella a drink, you pour till the ice floats." And then he bade me goodbye and I went on. But that was my visit with
George. You said that Truman remarked that all he could see from room 814 in the Patton Hotel were the old railroad sheds and tracks. And if he looked out of that room today, as you're talking, he would see Miller Park, Bicentennial Library, new skyscraper buildings going, and very lovely
office,
downtown.
That office building going up on the corner.
And the office building going up on the corner, the skyscraper building that's going there. That's what he would see today.
But the thing that amazed me was the man's memory.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes.
And when I placed my arm, my hand over on his shoulder, he didn't resent it. He had on a gray suit with sort of a dark-looking little pattern in it. And he had on that American Legion button, mm-hmm. a pin with a diamond in it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'd have talked with him 10 more minutes, it wouldn't have made no difference to him. But that other fellow was having a hissy up there.
Yeah. And I left. But that's one of the great hallmarks of the good American politician, the recollection for small detail, friendship, the warm story, the anecdote, Jim Farley never forgetting a face and sending you a Christmas card every year of your life signed in green ink, Irish green, all that sort of thing. That's what makes the color to it. You've known it.
John, now in all the talking that we've done, I haven't said a thing about one of the most colorful men that we had on the commission. And I'm, of course, talking about Bookie Turner.
Oh, yeah.
Bookie Turner was the commissioner of fire and police. And he was determined that fire department have the newest type of equipment that there was to fight fire with.
Mm-hmm.
And he just wouldn't give up at any budget meeting or any time there was any federal money that could be spent for a purpose like that. He would not give up until he got it. Now I think, and a lot of people have criticized the bookie like they've criticized me or anybody else, but I think that one of the big reasons why we've got an outstanding fire department in Chattanooga today is because back in those days, Bookie Turner just kept raising Cain until the rest of us on the commission gave him the money to do what he wanted to do. Not all of it, but you never could have pleased him.
It worked for his constituency.
That's right. Now, John, I want to say this, that Mary Helen and I, my wife, we were married in the 30s, and we both had to work. Mary Helen opened a clinic, a child's clinic, on Lindsay Street for Dr. John Hocker. John Hocker.
Mm-hmm.
Great big fella. Married one of the Sloan girls up on the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very successful. And Mary Helen was in charge of the office and the other help and so forth, but we both had to work. And of course, at that time, our oldest daughter, Judy, was born. And from somewhere, there came into our home one of the finest black ladies that I ever met. She came into our home and she completely took over. She cared for Judy, our daughter Judy, just as if she were her own. And in turn, Judy loved Buster. And then when our son came, she thought just as much of Ricky as she did Buster. And I can always remember that if one of the children came to their mother or to me and said, I want to do so and so, and we told them that they couldn't, they said, we'll go ask Vesta. And now with the grandchildren, they think just as much of Vesta.
She's still with you?
She's over 45 years, she's been in my home.
Mm-hmm.
And she could take better care of Mary Helen than a nurse. Now, Vesta thinks today that my 45-year-old daughter, who lives in Williamsburg, don't know how to fix a Christmas dinner. And she goes up there with some of us every Christmas, and she does the cooking.
For that girl?
That's right.
Yeah. In Williamsburg, Virginia?
That's right. No. Now, when Mary Helen was completely overcome by arthritis, Vesta seldom left her side. She could do more for Mary Helen than a nurse could. And we took Vesta to Warm Springs the last 2 weeks that Mary Helen was there, at the suggestion of the doctors at Warm Springs, so that Vesta could learn to give my wife the same exercises and things that they gave her at Warm Springs. And now she thinks that there's no way in the world that I can do without her. And I couldn't.
Yeah.
She comes to my house every Wednesday, my apartment. She cleans it up. And she washes and irons. If it says don't iron, she irons it.
She knows what's best.
That's right. And I told Vesta one time, I said, Vesta, mother's gone, the children are gone and married, but I want you to know this, that you know we McIntyres have never been blessed with a lot of money. But every time that I make a dollar, some little part of it is going to be yours. And it still is.
Yeah.
And I want to say something about my wife's only sister, Julia Ruth Richards. There's a Mary Helen's life when she couldn't get around except in a wheelchair. Julia Ruth came to our home every Saturday night, not every other Saturday night, but every Saturday night, and stayed through Sunday so that I could go teach a Sunday school class and go to church. Now, I can't ever be too grateful for Julia Ruth, my sister-in-law. Now, I'm through with those sentimental things now, and I want to go back to my last election, which was in 1963. Chattanooga was still going forward. And Ralph Kelly had now become in favor of annexation. And we began to annex. And we did it in the right sort of way. And everything went good. And just after I had been elected in 1963, Mother and I were at home alone. Rick was married, lived here, and Judy, our daughter, was married and lived in Williamsburg. But we were sitting in the family room, and she turned to me one night, just out of a clear blue sky, and she says, Daddy, when this term is over, unless you and me find something else to do, you and me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I said, Mother, you mean that? She said, I sure do. Now, I've always felt like, but I've never mentioned it, that one of the reasons she felt that way about me doing something else was, in those days it was popular for a man's wife to be out stumping with him.
Mm.
And she couldn't do it. She couldn't use the telephone. But nevertheless...
So crippled with arthritis.
Nevertheless, I told her, I said, well now, it isn't long before the children will be at home. Judy will be here from Williamsburg and Ricky's here. And you and I and the children will talk it over. And we did. And that was my agreement with her. Now that was 4 years away.
Mm-hmm.
And during the last year, I went to four of my friends and told them that I was not going to be a candidate for re-election to the commission. I went first to Scotty Probasco Jr. Then I went to my old dear buddy and constituent, Rudy O'Johnny. And then I went to one of the best Jewish friends I ever had, Sid Perlberg. And then one of the other dearest friends that I ever had lived in Rossville, Georgia. And everybody called him Sheriff, Sheriff Ledford. His name was Artie Ledford, but everybody called him Sheriff. So I told those four people that I was not going to run for public office. Now Scotty said, George, you can't quit. And I explained to him. Well, I admire you for it. Said anything I can do to help you, I'll do it. And then 6 months before my term was to expire, Mary Helen had asked me to announce it before her birthday. And her birthday was in November. And 6 months before that campaign, I wrote out a statement, and at 12:30 I had informed all of my staff to be in my office. And there never was a member of the commission that had a better staff than I did, more loyal. A man like Bill Teppenpaul, my general superintendent, if I ask him in the morning, we always met in the morning for a few minutes. I'd say, Bill, can you get so-and-so done by 4 o'clock this afternoon? He'd figure a minute, and he'd say yes. I didn't have to go by. Paul Woods was the park superintendent.
Oh, yeah.
And he had Miss Dorsey out there. And Bill Teppenpaul had Peggy Held in the office. And Ruth Bird was the recreation director. But to those loyal people, that was the hardest group that I ever had to make such a statement to. Because, well, Miss Elizabeth is responsible for everything that's happening to me today. She kept the records.
Mm-hmm.
She kept my checkbook. She answered half of my mail. She did my income tax. She told me when I was running low in one department and ought to change money to another.
These are the people that make a city official
function.
That's
right. It's not you.
You may have the charisma, but they can give you the, they can fill in the interstices of your life.
Now, I met with them at 12:30. And then I had called a special meeting of the city commission to meet in the mayor's office at 1:30. This was on a commission meeting day on a Tuesday. And at 1:30, I had them in the mayor's office. And the press wanted in, and I said, no, man, I'll talk to you later. I read them this same statement. They said, George, you're in good shape politically. I said, well, I'm going to. But I'm doing it for exactly the reason that I've written out on this paper. And then we went in commission meeting. And when it was over, I asked the press to stay. And I read it to them. They didn't believe it. I said, men, there it is. And I had my son there with me. They took my son's picture. I told him that my son and I were going in the real estate business. And after that, I even got invited to speak to the Rotary Club. Well, they'd ask a mayor or something, you know, but they never would have asked a commissioner to speak to the Rotary Club. And they gave me a standing ovation and presented me a cake with 20 candles on it, denoting the number of years I'd spent at the city hall.
Mm-hmm.
And then little groups all over town, little garden club groups, or a civic group, would invite me out to a little party and give me some little memento that I've cherished ever since.
Oh, sure.
And always will. It was one of the most important feelings to know what people told you and what they did for you.
One of the deep satisfactions of public life, public service.
And now I'm going into my final few days at City Hall.
All right.
Floyd Delaney came by my office one day.
He was in the insurance business at that time.
He was with
Interstate,
Secretary and Treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "George, on such and such a date," and I didn't make any, the date didn't cut any ice for me. I didn't know that. I didn't know it was the last day that I was going to be in office. I didn't know that's when my term was expired. But he said, "On such and such a day, I'm going to take you to lunch." And at that time, the Interstate had a little cafeteria out there, and I'd been out there to have lunch with he or Clay or some of them before. I said, "What time you want me to be out there?" He said, "Oh, I'm not going to feed you in our cafeteria." He said, "I'm going to take you someplace like a reed house and feed you like you ought to be fed." And Miss Elizabeth was in on it. And when that day finally came, Floyd Delaney came by the office to get me. And I still didn't know anything about a lunch, and I thought we was going in the green room and eat. We walked in the front door of the readouts. And when he started going around and to start up those stairways on the Chestnut Street side, I knew that something was happening. And just as Floyd and I started in the door, somebody opened the door, and there was the speaker's table. There sat my preacher, and there was my daughter, who'd been flown in from Williamsburg. Then there was Ricky and his wife, Mary Ann. And then there was Mother. And old Scotty was standing there with his bow tie and a big grin on, like he always does. And that was Floyd Delaney. He'd already taken his place up there. And there was Judge Frost. And there was Tom Duff, the president of the Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruth Byrd, my recreation director. And then I looked out into that audience, and that Continental Room was filled. I saw people who worked in my department. Miss Elizabeth, she had to sit down. She wouldn't have taken the front seat.
Yeah.
There were people out of my Sunday school class. There was people who held the highest jobs in Chattanooga. DeSales Harris.
Oh, yeah.
The Johnson boys. Summerfield Johnson. And some of the men from this bank, and the Provident, and Joe Davenport from the Volunteer. Full.
Mm-hmm.
And Scotty was a master of ceremonies. and he called on our preacher to say something. And then he called on Ruth Bird, our recreation director, who was going to speak for our staff. And they called on Judge Frost to say something as the county judge. And they called on Tom Duff to say something as the president of the Chamber of Commerce. And then Floyd Delaney said, "Scotty, we're about to forget something here." And Scotty said, "What's that? Aren't we through?" And he said, "No," said, "here's the keys to the car." They gave me a brand new automobile.
Mm-hmm.
And John, it was the third new automobile that I ever owned. And it was the first new automobile I'd ever owned that I didn't have monthly payments to make on.
After all those years in public life.
And they gave Mary Helen a check for $500. You see, I said a few minutes ago that Mary Helen and I both had to work to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to the city hall to fill out that unexpired term, the salary of a commissioner was $4,000
mm-hmm.
a year. And when I left 20 years later, it was $11,250.
Mm-hmm.
Just slightly above the poverty line for a family of four.
Now,
that's the price you pay.
That's right. But here's one thing that I possess. I think I possess two of the greatest assets that any man can own. It's family. I don't have to worry about my children.
Hmm.
Ricky took off and went into law school and came back. He wanted to be a real estate lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's a title attorney with Milligan and Reynolds. They pay in money.
Real money.
And my daughter, she is the supervisor of all of the elementary schools in Newport News, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And her husband is the development director of the College of William and Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when a man's got a family like that, Ricky's got two little boys. Judy and Stan Brown have got two grown girls and a little boy. And you know something about the University of Virginia. My youngest granddaughter, Jan, told me when she got out of high school, she said, "Granddaddy, I'm going to the University of Virginia." I said, "Well, honey, isn't it hard for girls to get in?" She said, "Yeah, I've known." And this year, she finished her third year with a grade of 3.8.
On a 4-0 scale. Wonderful.
And the oldest daughter graduates at the end of summer school at the University of Madison, which is up at Harrisburg, Virginia.
That's right.
Well, to have a family like that,
that'll sustain you through anything.
And that other thing that's so important is friends.
And you've got them, George. I know that. I walk down the street myself, and even after you've walked down the street, if I come down the street and say I saw George McIntyre, they spend 5 minutes talking to me about you.
Oh.
That's right. That's right.
Now,
that's
right. John, if I could say anything else, my interest, my heart is still set on downtown Chattanooga, on getting something else done. We've done a lot, but we need other things. And I am, as you know, the consultant for the Downtown Development Committee. And I'm
I think we should have something philosophical.
All right, now what I wanted to ask with them until they do. And I'm going to say this and quit. If I come through the cut in the ridge at night and look at all the beautiful lights of this beautiful city, I feel an inside satisfaction. Nothing to brag about. I don't brag about nothing. But inwardly, feeling of pride in that for over 20 years, I had just a little bit of something to do with Chattanooga. And I want to keep it up just as long as I live.
Well, I'd have to say, Mr. George, I've been a newspaper man here 20 years with the New York Times, with the Chattanooga Times, and I lived here some dozen years before that, covering the entire south of the New York Times, while observing this was my hometown. And I think the growth has been remarkable. I think the advances that Chattanooga made have been among the most promising of any city this size in the entire southeast. And I just happen to know, as an old and personal friend of yours and many of your close friends, that you had a great deal to do with it. That's one of the reasons why the people in this town have such high esteem, because the dream that you worked at has come true right in their presence while you were alive.
John, if I may, I want to go back to that luncheon that Floyd Delaney invited me to at the Reed House. A day that I shall never forget nor fail to appreciate. But that was my final day in public office. The party was over. The children took their mother home in the new car. I didn't want to talk. I walked out the back door of the Reed House and across 9th Street and up 9th Broad, down Broad to 11th, and then up 11th to the City Hall. I went upstairs by way of an elevator from the basement. Miss Elizabeth and Miss Betty were still there, but the tears had dried from their eyes, and there were a few things that I had that I wanted to take home. And I asked Miss Elizabeth to call Albert to come up and get the things that I had to put in the car and that I wanted him to drive me home. Albert was a faithful employee, a fine black man, but he seldom spoke until he was spoken to. And when we got home, pulled up in the driveway, I told Albert how much I appreciated him bringing me home. And he looked up at me and said, "Commissioner, I've worked for you for over 10 years, and you never once cussed me out." That meant something to me. Rick and I were in the real estate business, getting along pretty well. But what I want to say is this, that Mary Helen, whom I often call mother, lived a year and a half after I left the City Hall. I'd call her every morning, and I'd call her again in the middle of the afternoon. And she'd say, "Honey, why don't you come on home? Vesta will have something for us to eat now or later, and you can take me for a ride." And almost every day, if the weather wasn't bad, I would lift her into the front seat of the car, fold up her wheelchair and put it in the trunk, and we would head for Eastgate. And time after time, day after day, I drove her through every store in Eastgate. She loved every minute of it. And there were times when I could take her even to the Tivoli Theater, where I could roll her down and sit her on an end seat. I could also get her into the auditorium by the same way. Considering her condition, I believe that it was as happy as any year and a half that we ever spent together. A lot of people came to visit Mary Helen. And oftentimes when they ran into me, they'd say, "George, I got more pleasure out of seeing Mary Helen than she got from my visit." But you can't imagine what a wonderful time. The children all gone, nobody there but mother, and a lot of times Vesta and me. What a wonderful time we had together. It's something that I would not have, if I had not done what she asked me, if I'd run for office again and had been elected, and she'd still died a year and a half later, I never would have forgiven myself. It was the most beautiful time in our entire life. Rick and I went to work, and we made a sort of a living. But the thing that I think so often about is how we would sit in her chair and I in mine, watching some television program, holding hands. She was a wonderful wife, a wonderful mother, and a wonderful Christian person. And I always thank the good Lord that He gave me the job, gave me the courage to leave office at the time that I did.
In your judgment, George, what should be the goals of young people entering public life these days? What rewards can they expect if they succeed? Moreover, what would you define as the essential ingredient or ingredients for creating a viable and workable city or community in this country as drawn from the experience of your own personal history? Can you answer that, John?
John, that's a whole lot of questions. And I can answer it only in this way. Every person, no matter what sex, color, creed, or financial status, owes something to his or her country and something to his or her community. It is a responsibility that comes with freedom. Probably most people get their first test of politics when they actively support a friend or some person they admire who becomes a candidate for office. But once caught up in the excitement of a campaign, sooner or later, many of those young people will face this question: why don't I run for a public office? Then comes the time of soul searching. Why do I want to become a city commissioner, or a councilman, or a sheriff? Can I do a better job than the one in office or the other candidate? What does the job involve? Will it require more of my time than regular jobs? What's in it for me? First, I think the answer is again that we all owe something. We can't all be candidates, but we can work and vote for those we believe will give us the best government. It's sad that only about half of those qualified go to the polls and vote. successful candidate and office holder, you must respect people, all of them, and learn to love them, or you will be working for them far more hours than you first thought, and it won't be easy. Much of the time you will feel you are not appreciated. Your opponents will scorn your efforts, and some will try to vilify you. Campaigning is very hard, and it requires a lot of money, and you must be willing to work until you drop, and you must find legitimate sources of finances in order to properly advertise your campaign. Any personal contact with the people, most of them strangers, look right into their eye and with a firm handshake, tell them the truth and what you want to do as their representative. And if you win, if you are elected, then comes the acid test. Sure, you can do the job. You are able, efficient, a good organizer, and very likely the best one of the candidates. The people made a good choice. Everything is great. But then, sometimes subtly and sometimes harshly, comes the pressure. Soon everybody wants something, and it seems that they all voted for you. It comes from all sides. Individuals, citizens group, labor, management, the power structure, special interests. You wish you had never dreamed of public office, but you ask for it, so you accept the challenge. You work, you plan, you organize, you meditate, you persuade, you cajole, you feel like a full-time diplomat. Sometimes you're exhausted, but you're glad you're there on top of the job. What's in it for me? Well, for all this dedicated work and devotion, almost certainly you will be making more money in a number of other fields. And sure, if you're really ambitious and good at political maneuvering, you might be elected mayor. And might some, but even if you just stay right where you are and do the best job you can, there's a lot more to it than money. Knowing that you are doing a good, honest job, that you are serving the people as you promised to do, is a reward far more important than the paycheck you get. Some people won't understand that, but they will know what it means. You will know what it means to be a good public servant. I love Chattanooga, and I believe the city we all envision can evolve only through the complete cooperation of the city and county governments and our business leaders working together for what is best for the entire community. Looking back, I believe that much has been accomplished. We are well on the way. But now, Mr. Mayor or Mr. Commissioner, between my time and yours, much more will have been done. But there will be something just as important yet unfinished. I believe that you will be a part of doing the job.
George, I want to thank you for a splendid interview. You and I have known each other a number of years, been on many platforms together. I've played news in the paper that concerns you and your events in the city, in Chattanooga. I certainly want to say, along with every other citizen in the city at this time, you're one of the finest public servants we ever had. You made wonderful contributions to this city, and all of us today can see evidence of how you put your shoulder to the wheel and the people with whom you associated. And as you know, the Chattanooga Area Historical Association, has decided that whenever possible, it would like to make oral tapes, oral interviews, with political figures who can tell of the times in which they lived, who can give anecdotes that highlight the political flavor of the community at that time. And they chose you for the simple reason of what this interview itself has shown: your capacity for telling a good story, your understanding of the political forces at play, your understanding of the needs of the community and the manner in which they had to be maneuvered in order to be met. I also understood from this oral interview that, in effect, they had lived with a man amongst them who was a fine citizen, George McIntyre. We are deeply indebted to you, George, for what you've done for us. Thank you.
Okay.